You are listening to Justice Radio on WMPG. I'm Emily Goulette from Maine Indigent Defense Center, and today we're speaking with Mika Gonzalez from Northeastern University School of Law. Mika, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Emily. So I am in my second year of law school at Northeastern. Before that, I was working as like a community organizer, essentially, particularly with trans and queer asylum seekers, most of them also being like youth. And I did that for a couple of years, and that's sort of what really ended up leading me into law school, just kind of seeing as an organizer a lot of just the inequality in the system, how inaccessible it was for people. And yeah, I just felt like I've had the privilege to have access to an incredible education. So I just wanted to do something with it to give back to the community.
That's amazing. And what are you focusing on in law school or wanting to do when you're done?
Yeah, I have really pivoted slightly towards criminal defense. I think that at first I was, because of my like background working with asylum seekers, I was thinking about doing immigration. And then it started to feel a little too close to home as an immigrant. I ended up just really finding a lot of overlap in between criminal defense and the work I was doing in immigration before. And it's just felt like a really good fit so far. I'm not entirely sure if this is what I will end up doing. You know, I've still got some time before I finish school to figure things out. But so far, it's feeling like a really good fit. And I'm hoping to continue to do that.
That's awesome. I hope you do. Okay. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah. So I was hoping to talk today a little bit about, I guess the question being like, you know, is there a path forward through transformative justice to reimagine what the criminal justice system looks like right now, right? So thinking through like the need for a more holistic approach to, you know, dealing with these issues that the criminal justice system alleges to try to resolve. And yeah, just thinking about what opportunities exist beyond the traditional system and what we have just kind of accepted as like the status quo of how we address these issues. I worked for a while doing a lot of like leading restorative justice and transformative justice circles, and just trying to use those methods to resolve community problems a lot of the times around violence. I think that it's particularly effective in dealing with like domestic violence and instances like that. But I think that there's opportunity to bring in sort of like the philosophy and theories and knowledge that come from transformative justice and restorative justice into dealing with all kinds of community problems, those that deal with violence, but really any kind of like dispute or disagreement or harm that's been done.
Yeah. So I was really excited that you wanted to talk about this, because that's our whole thing here, right? Is holistic defense. And what you're talking about specifically, restorative justice circles and that type of a holistic approach, is a little bit different than how we think of a holistic approach here, which, you know, that's something that we've talked about on here a lot of times. So would you be able to kind of explain the difference and also how they could work together?
So, I mean, I think that how they function differently, I mean, it kind of essentially boils down to the fact that, you know, when you're doing like criminal defense, I mean, that's sort of the last, you know, the last point, right? At like the harm has been done, the person is being forced into like interacting with the system, right? So automatically kind of like the avenues that are available to you, the kinds of processes that you need to engage in are just inherently different, because there is this whole official like legal structure that you're now having to like navigate. But I think that, you know, the basic idea of understanding that, you know, these issues are systemic, that they're tied to bigger networks of issues that, you know, don't just boil down to the individual, right? And I think that there is obviously room for a more holistic approach within criminal defense, and just like, you know, when you're dealing with a client, to really try to understand their full story, right? Understand the way that these greater systems are impacting and contributing to the way that, to whatever situation led them to be in front of us in the office, right? Or in front of the court. And, you know, by trying to hold that entire picture as we're like building the case, right? Even though, I mean, obviously it's very limited, like in terms of addressing big systemic issues, like what we can actually do as attorneys, right? But I think that by centering this reality, right, and by trying to center your relationship with the clients and how you move forward in a way that kind of holds all of these complexities, even if we can't directly address them, you know, what we can do is to try to really present to the system a whole person, a whole story, an entire narrative, right? Not just boiling them down to what's probably likely one of the worst days of their lives, right? And obviously, when you are working outside of the system, there's a lot more room for creativity. There's a lot less like barriers or expectations of like, this is how this process has to work and this is how you have to move through it. But I think that there is a lot of room for us to do as much as we can to try to bring the concepts into how we, move through the work once we are, dealing within the system. And yeah, I don't know if that was a super direct response, but
No, that was exactly what I meant. And I'm also thinking about, like, you specifically mentioned domestic violence cases, and we have a little bit of a system here for DV court or drug court or these specific categories, but it's also really limited who those courts are. Who's eligible to be in those? And it's nowhere near, it's great that we have it, but it's nowhere near reaching everybody that could benefit from those services. So I like how you're kind of taking it one step further than how we think of things. We think of things like we say each person, we're trying to get to the root cause of why they ended up in the criminal justice system, which is usually has absolutely nothing to do with the crime that they committed. But you're saying we need to kind of redo the system in general to work with all of those people. So I completely agree, but how are we doing that? I believe you. You're gonna do it, but how?
A way of reframing things that I always really appreciate. I think that oftentimes we find ourselves like stuck in this position where it's like, okay, do we lean towards reform or are we leaning towards like, oh, you have to destroy the dismantle the entire system, tear it all down? And I think that sometimes that kind of thinking really gets us stuck. And I think sometimes by letting go of those questions a bit and saying, okay, how can we right here, right now, start building the kinds of systems that we want, right? I think that that is always a really powerful way of recentering how we do this work. And, I think that obviously it's not clear cut. If it was, if we had all these answers, I think that we would be much further along in this process than we are. And I think, a lot of it is very situation specific, right? It's very dependent on like what does the immediate community look like? What options have already been tried? What options have worked? Which options haven't? I completely agree that while these, like alternative courts, like mental health court, DV court, stuff like that, sure, it's a step in the right direction. It still leaves out so many people, right? And I think that where we can start building a more inclusive alternative, and perhaps not even just an alternative, but something that can kind of coexist alongside, is really rooted in like community organizing work. And I think I'm obviously a little biased on this because that is the work that I did for a really long time. But I think that a good model that I think we can borrow a lot from and be inspired by is a lot of the work that's been done sort of around reentry, especially work that's being like led by people who were actually incarcerated, right? I think it's about having to working towards developing the kinds of community systems that are capable of holding people, right? And navigating, helping them navigate all of the awful systemic things that, tend to lead you into, unfortunately, oftentimes having to commit crimes out of just survival. It's a slow process, that is for sure. But I think that there are a couple of ways that we can, build towards that. And I do think that there is, a role that lawyers can play in supporting community organizers, in developing these kinds of networks and these kinds of systems. I think that there is a lot that we can do around like democratizing legal education, right? Like making sure that people have access to this information before they are in this situation where they need a lawyer because X and Y thing happened, right? I think that that is something that's really huge and that there's a really big need for it. And I also just think like we need more cooperation and collaboration between different social services that exist, and creating opportunities for us to not have to be so reliant on those social services that are coming directly from the state and the government, right? Because a lot of the times, things get caught up in a bunch of red tape and bureaucracy, and it just means that people are not able to access what they actually need, right? So, you know, in my experience, like when I was organizing, a lot of the work that we were doing was building up sort of alternative parallel systems. And this work was only possible by having professionals whose values aligned with our collective who were stepping in and kind of sharing this knowledge, right? Like, for example, like people who are social workers or attorneys who were stepping in and saying, like, these are programs or opportunities or things that I have seen work through the work that I do. And because a lot of the times, like information about how to access these things is just not readily available, right? And so, how can we work together to create structures that make it a little bit more seamless, that make it more accessible for people to have access to these programs? And a lot of the times, I mean, we can just create them ourselves, right? And I think you see that in, you know, like a lot of work that's been done around helping unhoused folks with just getting access to their like basic needs, right? Things like, you know, organizing like harm reduction groups or organizing like drives to get people access to certain resources, whether that be food or clothing or, you know, basic necessities. I mean, how many times do we see cases where people are being picked up on charges for stealing like body wash and food? And yeah, I think that there is so much work to do that it feels a little sort of overwhelming to try to think about like a concrete step or like a concrete path towards doing it. But I think so much of it just has to do with like getting together as like-minded people, not being afraid to have these conversations, really listening deeply to the people that are most impacted by these systems and saying, okay, what do you need? And what can I do as an individual, or what can I do just with like a group of people that I know and have access to and trust? Like, how can we help each other? How can we be in community with one another? And I think that a lot of the times, the way that these systems are structured, it creates all of these barriers in us having to like how, you know, people are able to like articulate and communicate what their needs are, right? And I think that sometimes when we allow ourselves to work within more informal structures, sure, it might not always be as efficient or as clean and, you know, straightforward. But I do think that like that kind of more informal, creative, on the spot, thinking through resolutions, I think it also creates a lot of opportunities for creative solutions that sometimes when we're just stuck working inside the system, like we're not, like we can't see all of the other possibilities that exist beyond it.
Yeah, and something that I've noticed, well, I guess a couple of things. So, one is that these types of programs, I find that we're more willing to test these things out on like violent crime categories. I don't know exactly why. I think, you know, it's easier to set up a system of especially with like the restorative justice circles where there's, you know, a set victim that's a human, because then it's like a human to human thing. And that's great that we're willing to do that for those, but the vast majority of the people who are stuck in this, you know, like you said, like criminalizing poverty cycle, these are not violent crimes. And so where I get stuck sometimes is how to kind of facilitate ideas like this for those people, which is the biggest group, because, you know, like you, everything that you've said, we're just telling people. I'm looking at your notes that you sent me, and it says, you know, get sober, get a job, pay your taxes, act like a respectable member of society. Like, that's all we're giving people who are outside of these categories that we've decided to try things out on. And so that can be really frustrating, I feel like, for us here sometimes, because we have all these clients who are just trying to survive.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that when I was working with the Trans Asylum Seekers Support Network, you know, in that instance, like I think there's a lot of overlap between these kinds of clients that you're talking about and a lot of what I saw, you know, supporting asylum seekers in that, you know, your options are so limited, right? I mean, when you're an asylum seeker, you can't work for the first year. how are you supposed to survive in those instances, right? Or like, with a lot of the clients that we see in the office, right? Like, people who are dealing with like very severe mental health issues, or just, something as simple as like, the way that trauma just like aggregates, right? All of these things and, builds on top of each other to make it just really difficult to just navigate these systems in the first place, right? And, when I was working in TASN, honestly, the solutions that we came up with was a lot of it was just fundraising and giving people direct access to funds. We were fundraising a lot of money. And it was grassroots fundraising where like our average donations were like $5, but we were able to pool together enough resources to provide housing for, I believe the largest group of people that we were ever supporting at once was about like 30 individuals, right? And that looked like, providing them either a stipend for rent, or we would rent apartments like in our organization's name and provide housing for people, right? I think like there's been a lot of success with different versions of like housing first programs around the country. I think something like that is a really good place to start, right? Really like coming together to just provide people access to alternatives and alternatives that are, coming without judgment or without this like very like infantilizing, like
Like, I
paternalistic.
handed this down to you,
Exactly.
and so now you're like, you didn't actually earn this. That like you're just traumatizing people more.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, it's humiliating, right? To be put in that position where you're having to essentially like beg and reframe your entire lived experience in this way to try to like get sympathy from people who have access to resources, right? And a lot of the times, I mean, I think it's very natural to develop a resentment there, right? And it makes it so much harder to like step through this. And I think that that's a big reason why I think when you are trying to build these kinds of organizations and these kinds of alternative systems, I think it's really important to always center survivors, right? Always center people that are being most negatively impacted by these systems, and build ways and an infrastructure that allows them to like, okay, once you've regained some level of stability, like, organize with us, be a part of this effort, right? In the sense that I think that the more systems impacted people who are leading these kinds of efforts, the better the results will ultimately be, right? And I think that, those of us who are privileged enough to never have been in those kinds of situations, right? And are actively trying to participate in building these kinds of alternatives, like I think it requires we need to stay humble and to, check ourselves and be real about those things and really think critically and hold ourselves accountable as we move through it, right?
I have a follow-up for you, but we'll pause for a second. You're listening to Justice Radio. My name is Emily Goulet from Maine Indigent Defense Center, and again, we're talking to Mika Gonzalez from Northeastern University. Going back to what you were saying, I think we always end up talking about the money aspect of things on here, but that ultimately is, where it comes back to. You said, like the stigma on asylum seekers, and they can't, it's not their fault that they can't work for the first year, but then, we're saying that they come here and all our tax money and like the housing, we're paying for housing for, I'm like, what are you talking about? As if they wouldn't be working if that was possible for them. People want to be able to support themselves. It doesn't feel good for people to not be able to do that. We punish people that we don't think fit into this like perfect thing that we want to see. And we punish people by putting them in prison or and making them homeless. So then they end up in prison. Yeah, it's devastating. But I completely get what you're saying. It's hard to say a concrete step to, I mean, the housing first programs, I am a very strong believer in, organizations should definitely be housing first. We can't expect people to get a job while you're not gonna get hired while you're homeless. You're not gonna, if you can't go home and take a shower, You're not going to keep your job. You're not going to cook your dinner so that you can have enough energy going for you to, I mean, it's just stuff that people don't even think about. I also noticed you say transformative justice
Yes.
instead of restorative justice. Can you explain the difference?
I think that, there's a lot of conflicting opinions about what exactly the difference is and like where do you draw the line between one and the other. I think that restorative justice tends to focus a bit more on the individual, right? Like I think traditional restorative justice framework is, person A causes harm to person B. And the idea is that we're going to come together as a community to try to hold person A accountable for the harm that they've done. And we're trying to restore person B, the person who was harmed, right, to as close to where they were before, or to try to give them kind of like what they feel that they need to heal, right? And to feel like, the harm that was done against them, that somebody has been held accountable for that, right? Whereas I feel like transformative justice really takes it a step further. And instead of focusing on the individual and the individual harm that's been done, it's really more about acknowledging the wider system that is impacting all of these people, right? And the wider system that is creating the conditions of violence, whether that violence be like literal interpersonal violence or just the violence of living under capitalism and not having access to these things, right? I appreciate the fact that transformative justice really centers this idea that we cannot think about these problems in their individual, like, because the second that we do, we are losing sight of the bigger picture, right? Because sure, like we were talking about earlier, how a lot of the times in these attempts to like, involve like restorative justice principles into alternative court systems, right? The person, like, usually it's you have to be a first offender, right? Or young, or, someone who the court essentially thinks can more easily be rehabilitated, right? And sure, okay, let's say this person manages to go through this restorative justice process that first time around, but none of the conditions of violence that, like systemic violence that led them to committing that crime in the first place have been addressed, right? So sure, they can get through that, but at the end of the day, nothing about the material conditions of their life has changed, right? And they will, it then just becomes so easy to slip back into these cycles that eventually lead back to the exact same place. And that second time around, that person is not going to have access to these alternative justice systems, right? Because now the court sees them as someone who couldn't get help, someone who's more deserving of punishment. And, with transformative justice, like by always centering and framing the bigger systems that are impacting and creating these conditions, it becomes a lot harder to sort of lose sight of what's really at stake, right? And it just, I think, forces us to think a little bit more critically who and what exactly needs to be held accountable. It forces us to really think about why these harms are happening in the first place, right? And I think that centering those ideas is really important. And I think that by centering those ideas, it opens up possibilities for more effective, creative solutions.
Yeah, and why are they happening in the first place? And also, why in 2025 do we not have a better way to prevent them? And I mean, I don't know if it's cynical or just reality, but because we want people in prison,
Yeah. I
it
mean,
makes
we
them
can't deny
money.
that. There's a
Yeah.
right.
And that's it. I feel like people have a really hard time with that kind of reality that, we want people in prison, it makes money, and people are immediately, that's not true. But it's the information is
It is.
it's available for you. Rob and I always go back and forth because we've talked about the diff like the meaning of being an abolitionist and being, I say that I am, but then you always get the argument like, well, what about the murderers? Like, where are the murderers gonna go? I'm like, do you realize how small a percentage that is compared to even just like keeping undocumented people in prison that didn't even do anything compared to petty crimes, survival type crimes, and then that is this whole big thing with this little bitty thing on the end is like a couple of murderers. Not, I'm not saying like, let's let murderers run around free, but that's not the point.
Right. That's not the point. And I also think that, like, and this is probably where, when I say things like this, people get a little stressed out. But even violent criminals, I think even when we're talking about and dealing with violent criminals, I think we need to really think critically about what leads people into these systems of violence, right? How do they work? Because 99% of the time, even when you have someone who has committed murder or who is a rapist, right? Like these really violent, awful crimes that our minds always want to jump to when we get nervous about the idea of prison abolition, right? Even in those instances, there is so much community work that could be done to prevent even those kinds of violent crimes. And I really don't think that prison is the solution for them, right? And I think that sometimes, when you get caught up in the system that is so violent and your entire life, all you are exposed to is this consistent stream of violence, I think it becomes very understandable that people are going to feel like they have no other option but this violence that is all that the system has ever allowed them to know, right? And I think that, most people who commit violent crimes can be rehabilitated, right? I mean, this boogeyman that we have of this sociopath who has no feelings for people and who does this because it brings them pleasure. I mean, that is such a small percentage, right?
But
Such a
that's
small
what we
percentage.
get in, pop culture is like with all like the true crime and the
Right.
like movies about serial killers, like that's what people think of because that's
Right.
what we know about, and we
Right.
don't know about all of the other people that aren't
Right.
so like sensational.
I mean, we don't talk about the kids who grew up in underfunded neighborhoods who gangs is just like a part of their daily life, and they don't really have much of an option, right? And they don't have access to a good education or any of the tools that they would need to pull themselves out of the system. It's right in front of them. They fall into this life, but they're not bad people at the end of the day, right? And I think that that's a hard idea for a lot of people to really sit with, right? And I think that a lot of the times I think it makes our lives easier and it makes us a little bit more comfortable, right? To think of this us versus them dynamic, right? Like these people who are deserving of this or who are, less worthy of freedom or opportunities. And I think that a lot of, the system is built that way on purpose, right? Like so much about the system is about dehumanizing the other. And I think it's important for us to really push ourselves to see the humanity, even in those instances where we really don't want to, and it makes us deeply uncomfortable, right? I think that we can learn so much about ourselves and about the world that we live in and about folks that we are in community with, whether we like it or not, right? And I think that it's really important for all of us to just constantly engage in this self-reflection process because everything about the way that society is structured, especially within the criminal justice system, does not encourage that, right? It's such a dehumanizing system because it's easier to punish people and to look the other way and to accept what, at the end of the day, are human rights violations if we don't think of these people as humans, right? If we don't think of them as deserving, it's a lot easier, right? If we say, no, I'm so different than them, right? And I think it's an exercise in empathy that we need to constantly engage in.
Empathy, that's what we don't have a lot of right now. But we're all out of time, but thank you so much. And if I had to take away kind of like the most important things for me that you said, I mean, empathy, realizing even if we can't have these concrete steps, we need to be having these conversations with like-minded people, just thinking about ways that we can do that kind of grassroots work that I feel like a lot of times gets overlooked, because we feel like it's too small. It's not
Right.
gonna make the impact that I want it to. But especially with how, grants are going away for organizations like this,
Right. Right.
that's really all that we have left is that
Yeah.
grassroots work. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And thank you so much for listening to Justice Radio, and thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series. All right, bye-bye.